But no matter, I will give evidence against myself tomorrow at the trial. I'm determined to. I shall tell everything, everything. But we'll make our appearance together. And whatever you may say against me at the trial, whatever evidence you give, I'll face it. I am not afraid of you. I'll confirm it all myself. But you must confess, too. You must, we'll go together. That's how it shall be. Ivan said this solemnly and resolutely, and from his flashing eyes alone it could be seen that it would be so. You are ill, I see, you are quite ill. Your eyes are yellow, Smerdyakov commented, without the least irony. We'll go together, Ivan repeated. And if you won't go, no matter, I'll go alone. Smerdyakov paused as though pondering. There'll be nothing of the sort, and you won't go, he concluded at last positively. You don't understand me, Ivan exclaimed reproachfully. You'll be too much ashamed, if you confess it all. And, what's more, it will be no use at all, for I shall say straight out that I never said anything of the sort to you, and that you are either ill, and it looks like it, too, or that you're so sorry for your brother that you are sacrificing yourself to save him and have invented it all against me, for you've always thought no more of me than if I'd been a fly. And who will believe you, and what single proof have you got? Listen, you showed me those notes just now to convince me. Smerdyakov lifted the book off the notes and laid it on one side. Take that money away with you, Smerdyakov sighed. Of course, I shall take it. But why do you give it to me, if you committed the murder for the sake of it? Ivan looked at him with great surprise. I don't want it, Smerdyakov articulated in a shaking voice, with a gesture of refusal. I did have an idea of beginning a new life with that money in Moscow, or, better still, abroad. I did dream of it, chiefly because all things are lawful. That was quite right what you taught me, for you talked a lot to me about that. For if there's no everlasting God, there's no such thing as virtue, and there's no need of it. You were right there. So that's how I looked at it. Did you come to that of yourself? Asked Ivan, with a wry smile. With your guidance. And now, I suppose, you believe in God, since you are giving back the money? No, I don't believe, whispered Smerdyakov. Then why are you giving it back? Leave off. That's enough. Smerdyakov waved his hand again. You used to say yourself that everything was lawful, so now why are you so upset, too? You even want to go and give evidence against yourself. Only there'll be nothing of the sort. You won't go to give evidence, Smerdyakov decided with conviction. You'll see, said Ivan. It isn't possible. You are very clever. You are fond of money, I know that. You like to be respected, too, for you're very proud. You are far too fond of female charms, too, and you mind most of all about living in undisturbed comfort, without having to depend on anyone. That's what you care most about. You won't want to spoil your life forever by taking such a disgrace on yourself. You are like Fyodor Pavlovich, you are more like him than any of his children, you've the same soul as he had. You are not a fool, said Ivan, seeming struck. The blood rushed to his face. You are serious now, he observed, looking suddenly at Smerdyakov with a different expression. It was your pride made you think I was a fool. Take the money. Ivan took the three rolls of notes and put them in his pocket without wrapping them in anything. I shall show them at the court tomorrow, he said. Nobody will believe you. As you've plenty of money of your own, you may simply have taken it out of your cash box and brought it to the court. Ivan rose from his seat. I repeat, he said, the only reason I haven't killed you is that I need you for tomorrow. Remember that, don't forget it. Well, kill me. Kill me now, Smerdyakov said, all at once looking strangely at Ivan. You won't dare do that, Ivan. He added, with a bitter smile. You won't dare to do anything, you, who used to be so bold. Till tomorrow, cried Ivan, and moved to go out. Stay a moment. Show me those notes again. Ivan took out the notes and showed them to him. Smerdyakov looked at them for 10 seconds. Well, you can go, he said, with a wave of his hand. Ivan Fyodorovich. He called after him again. What do you want? Ivan turned without stopping. Good, bye. Till tomorrow. Ivan cried again, and he walked out of the cottage. The snowstorm was still raging. He walked the first few steps boldly, but suddenly began staggering. It's something physical, he thought with a grin. Something like joy was springing up in his heart. He was conscious of unbounded resolution. He would make an end of the wavering that had so tortured him of late. His determination was taken, and now it will not be changed, he thought with relief. At that moment he stumbled against something and almost fell down. Stopping short, he made out at his feet the peasant he had knocked down, still lying senseless and motionless. The snow had almost covered his face. Ivan seized him and lifted him in his arms. Seeing a light in the little house to the right, he went up, knocked at the shutters, and asked the man to whom the house belonged to help him carry the peasant to the police station, promising him 3 rubles. The man got ready and came out. I won't describe in detail how Ivan succeeded in his object, bringing the peasant to the police station and arranging for a doctor to see him at once, providing with a liberal hand for the expenses. I will only say that this business took a whole hour, but Ivan was well content with it. His mind wandered and worked incessantly. If I had not taken my decision so firmly for tomorrow, he reflected with satisfaction, I should not have stayed a whole hour to look after the peasant, but should have passed by, without caring about his being frozen. I am quite capable of watching myself, by the way, he thought at the same instant, with still greater satisfaction, although they have decided that I am going out of my mind. Just as he reached his own house, he stopped short, asking himself suddenly hadn't he better go at once to the prosecutor and tell him everything. He decided the question by turning back to the house. Everything together tomorrow, he whispered to himself, and, strange to say, almost all his gladness and self-satisfaction passed in one instant. As he entered his own room, he felt something like a touch of ice on his heart, like a recollection or, more exactly, a reminder of something agonizing and revolting that was in that room now, at that moment, and had been there before. He sank wearily on his sofa. The old woman brought him a samovar. He made tea, but did not touch it. He sat on the sofa and felt giddy. He felt that he was ill and helpless. He was beginning to drop asleep, but got up uneasily and walked across the room to shake off his drowsiness. At moments he fancied he was delirious, but it was not illness that he thought of most. Sitting down again, he began looking round, as though searching for something. This happened several times. At last his eyes were fastened intently on one point. Ivan smiled, but an angry flush suffused his face. He sat a long time in his place, his head propped on both arms, though he looked sideways at the same point, at the sofa that stood against the opposite wall. There was evidently something, some object, that irritated him there, worried him and tormented him. Chapter 9 The Devil. Ivan's nightmare. I am not a doctor, but yet I feel that the moment has come when I must inevitably give the reader some account of the nature of Ivan's illness. Anticipating events, I can say at least one thing: he was at that moment on the very eve of an attack of brain fever. Though his health had long been affected, it had offered a stubborn resistance to the fever which in the end gained complete mastery over it. Though I know nothing of medicine, I venture to hazard the suggestion that he really had perhaps, by a terrible effort of will, succeeded in delaying the attack for a time, hoping, of course, to check it completely. He knew that he was unwell, but he loathed the thought of being ill at that fatal time, at the approaching crisis in his life, when he needed to have all his wits about him, to say what he had to say boldly and resolutely and to justify himself to himself. He had, however, consulted the new doctor, who had been brought from Moscow by a fantastic notion of Katerina Ivanovna's to which I have referred already. After listening to him and examining him, the doctor came to the conclusion that he was actually suffering from some disorder of the brain, and was not at all surprised by an admission which Ivan had reluctantly made him. "Hallucinations are quite likely in your condition," the doctor opined, "though it would be better to verify them. You must take steps at once, without a moment's delay, or things will go badly with you." But Ivan did not follow this judicious advice and did not take to his bed to be nursed. "I am walking about, so I am strong enough. If I drop, it'll be different then. Anyone may nurse me who likes," he decided, dismissing the subject. And so he was sitting almost conscious himself of his delirium and, as I have said already, looking persistently at some object on the sofa against the opposite wall. Someone appeared to be sitting there, though goodness knows how he had come in, for he had not been in the room when Ivan came into it, on his return from Smerdyakov. This was a person or, more accurately speaking, a Russian gentleman of a particular kind, no longer young, qui faisait la cinquantaine, as the French say, with rather long, still thick, dark hair, slightly streaked with grey and a small pointed beard. He was wearing a brownish reefer jacket, rather shabby, evidently made by a good tailor though, and of a fashion at least 3 years old, that had been discarded by Smart and Well, two people for the last 2 years. His linen and his long scarf, like neck, tie were all such as are worn by people who aim at being stylish, but on closer inspection his linen was not over clean and his wide scarf was very threadbare. The visitor's check trousers were of excellent cut, but were too light in color and too tight for the present fashion. His soft fluffy white hat was out of keeping with the season. 50-ish. In brief, there was every appearance of gentility on straitened means. It looked as though the gentleman belonged to that class of idle landowners who used to flourish in the times of serfdom. He had unmistakably been, at some time, in good and fashionable society, had once had good connections, had possibly preserved them indeed, but, after a gay youth, becoming gradually impoverished on the abolition of serfdom, he had sunk into the position of a poor relation of the best class, wandering from one good old friend to another and received by them for his companionable and accommodating disposition and as being, after all, a gentleman who could be asked to sit down with anyone, though, of course, not in a place of honor. Such gentlemen of accommodating temper and dependent position, who can tell a story, take a hand at cards, and who have a distinct aversion for any duties that may be forced upon them, are usually solitary creatures, either bachelors or widowers. Sometimes they have children, but if so, the children are always being brought up at a distance, at some aunt's, to whom these gentlemen never allude in good society, seeming ashamed of the relationship. They gradually lose sight of their children altogether, though at intervals they receive a birthday or Christmas letter from them and sometimes even answer it. The countenance of the unexpected visitor was not so much good-natured, as accommodating and ready to assume any amiable expression as occasion might arise. He had no watch, but he had a tortoise-shell lorgnette on a black ribbon. On the middle finger of his right hand was a massive gold ring with a cheap opal stone in it. Ivan was angrily silent and would not begin the conversation. The visitor waited and sat exactly like a poor relation who had come down from his room to keep his host company at tea, and was discreetly silent, seeing that his host was frowning and preoccupied. But he was ready for any affable conversation as soon as his host should begin it. All at once his face expressed a sudden solicitude. "I say," he began to Ivan, "excuse me, I only mention it to remind you. You went to Smerdyakov's to find out about Katerina Ivanovna, but you came away without finding out anything about her, you probably forgot." "Ah, yes," broke from Ivan and his face grew gloomy with uneasiness. "Yes, I'd forgotten. But it doesn't matter now, never mind. Till tomorrow," he muttered to himself, "and you," he added, addressing his visitor, "I should have remembered that myself in a minute, for that was just what was tormenting me. Why do you interfere, as if I should believe that you prompted me, and that I didn't remember it of myself? Don't believe it then, said the gentleman, smiling amicably. What's the good of believing against your will? Besides, proofs are no help to believing, especially material proofs. Thomas believed, not because he saw Christ risen, but because he wanted to believe, before he saw. Look at the spiritualists, for instance. I am very fond of them. Only fancy, they imagine that they are serving the cause of religion, because the devils show them their horns from the other world. That, they say, is a material proof, so to speak, of the existence of another world. The other world and material proofs, what next? And if you come to that, does proving there's a devil prove that there's a God? I want to join an idealist society, I'll lead the opposition in it, I'll say I am a realist, but not a materialist, hee hee. Listen, Ivan suddenly got up from the table. I seem to be delirious. I am delirious, in fact, talk any nonsense you like, I don't care. You won't drive me to fury, as you did last time. But I feel somehow ashamed. I want to walk about the room. I sometimes don't see you and don't even hear your voice as I did last time, but I always guess what you are prating, for it's I myself speaking, not you. Only I don't know whether I was dreaming last time or whether I really saw you. I'll wet a towel and put it on my head and perhaps you'll vanish into air. Ivan went into the corner, took a towel, and did as he said, and with a wet towel on his head began walking up and down the room. I am so glad you treat me so familiarly, the visitor began. Fool, laughed Ivan. Do you suppose I should stand on ceremony with you? I am in good spirits now, though I've a pain in my forehead. And in the top of my head. Only please don't talk philosophy, as you did last time. If you can't take yourself off, talk of something amusing. Talk gossip, you are a poor relation, you ought to talk gossip. What a nightmare to have. But I am not afraid of you. I'll get the better of you. I won't be taken to a mad house. Quis charmant, poor relation. Yes, I am in my natural shape. For what am I on earth but a poor relation? By the way, I am listening to you and am rather surprised to find you are actually beginning to take me for something real, not simply your fancy, as you persisted in declaring last time. Never for one minute have I taken you for reality, Ivan cried with a sort of fury. You are a lie, you are my illness, you are a phantom. It's only that I don't know how to destroy you and I see I must suffer for a time. You are my hallucination. You are the incarnation of myself, but only of one side of me. Of my thoughts and feelings, but only the nastiest and stupidest of them. From that point of view you might be of interest to me, if only I had time to waste on you. Excuse me, I'll catch you. When you flew out at Alishaw under the lamp post this evening and shouted to him, you learnt it from him. How do you know that he visits me? You were thinking of me then. So for one brief moment you did believe that I really exist, the gentleman laughed blandly. Yes, that was a moment of weakness. But I couldn't believe in you. I don't know whether I was asleep or awake last time. Perhaps I was only dreaming then and didn't see you really at all. And why were you so surly with Alishaw just now? He is a dear, I've treated him badly over Father Zossimer. Don't talk of Alishaw. How dare you, you flunky. Ivan laughed again. You scold me, but you laugh, that's a good sign. But you are ever so much more polite than you were last time and I know why, that great resolution of yours. Don't speak of my resolution, cried Ivan, savagely. I understand, Christ noble, Christ charmant, you are going to defend your brother and to sacrifice yourself. Christ chevaleresque. Hold your tongue, I'll kick you. I shan't be altogether sorry, for then my object will be attained. If you kick me, you must believe in my reality, for people don't kick ghosts. Joking apart, it doesn't matter to me, scold if you like, though it's better to be a trifle more polite even to me. Fool, flunky. What words? Scolding you, I scold myself, Ivan laughed again, you are myself, only with a different face. You just say what I am thinking, and are incapable of saying anything new. If I am like you in my way of thinking, it's all to my credit, the gentleman declared, with delicacy and dignity. You choose out only my worst thoughts, and what's more, the stupid ones. You are stupid and vulgar. You are awfully stupid. No, I can't put up with you. What am I to do? What am I to do? Ivan said through his clenched teeth. My dear friend, above all things I want to behave like a gentleman and to be recognized as such, the visitor began in an access of deprecating and simple-hearted pride, typical of a poor relation. I am poor, but I won't say very honest, but it's an axiom generally accepted in society that I am a fallen angel. I certainly can't conceive how I can ever have been an angel. If I ever was, it must have been so long ago that there's no harm in forgetting it. Now I only prize the reputation of being a gentlemanly person and live as I can, trying to make myself agreeable. I love men genuinely, I've been greatly calumniated. Here when I stay with you from time to time, my life gains a kind of reality and that's what I like most of all. You see, like you, I suffer from the fantastic and so I love the realism of Earth. Here, with you, everything is circumscribed, here all is formulated and geometrical, while we have nothing but indeterminate equations. I wander about here dreaming. I like dreaming. Besides, on Earth I become superstitious. Please don't laugh, that's just what I like, to become superstitious. I adopt all your habits here, I've grown fond of going to the public baths, would you believe it? And I go and steam myself with merchants and priests. What I dream of is becoming incarnate once for all and irrevocably in the form of some merchant's wife weighing 18 stone, and of believing all she believes. My ideal is to go to church and offer a candle in simple, hearted faith, upon my word it is. Then there would be an end to my sufferings. I like being doctored too. In the spring there was an outbreak of smallpox and I went and was vaccinated in a foundling hospital. If only you knew how I enjoyed myself that day. I subscribed 10 rubles in the cause of the Slavs. But you are not listening. Do you know, you are not at all well this evening? I know you went yesterday to that doctor. Well, what about your health? What did the doctor say? Fool. Ivan snapped out. But you are clever, anyway. You are scolding again? I didn't ask out of sympathy. You needn't answer. Now rheumatism has come in again. Fool. Repeated Ivan. You keep saying the same thing, but I had such an attack of rheumatism last year that I remember it to this day. The devil have rheumatism. Why not, if I sometimes put on fleshly form? I put on fleshly form and I take the consequences. Satan sum et nihil humanimum alienum puncto. I am Satan, and deem nothing human alien to me. What, Satan sum et nihil humanum. That's not bad for the devil. I am glad I've pleased you at last. But you didn't get that from me. Ivan stopped suddenly, seeming struck. That never entered my head, that's strange. Quis du novo, nest, spa? This time I'll act honestly and explain to you. Listen, in dreams and especially in nightmares, from indigestion or anything, a man sees sometimes such artistic visions, such complex and real actuality, such events, even a whole world of events, woven into such a plot, with such unexpected details from the most exalted matters to the last button on the cuff, as I swear Leo Tolstoy has never invented. Yet such dreams are sometimes seen not by writers, but by the most ordinary people, officials, journalists, priests. The subject is a complete enigma. A statesman confessed to me, indeed, that all his best ideas came to him when he was asleep. Well, that's how it is now, though I am your hallucination, yet just as in a nightmare, I say original things which had not entered your head before. So I don't repeat your ideas, yet I am only your nightmare, nothing more. It's new, isn't it? You're lying, Your aim is to convince me you exist apart and are not my nightmare, and now you are asserting you are a dream. My dear fellow, I've adopted a special method today. I'll explain it to you afterwards. Stay, where did I break off? Oh, yes. I caught cold then, only not here but yonder. Where is yonder? Tell me, will you be here long? Can't you go away? Ivan exclaimed almost in despair. He ceased walking to and fro, sat down on the sofa, leaned his elbows on the table again and held his head tight in both hands. He pulled the wet towel off and flung it away in vexation. It was evidently of no use. Your nerves are out of order, observed the gentleman, with a carelessly easy, though perfectly polite, air. You are angry with me even for being able to catch cold, though it happened in the most natural way. I was hurrying then to a diplomatic soiree at the house of a lady of high rank in Petersburg, who was aiming at influence in the ministry. Well, an evening suit, white tie, gloves, though I was God knows where and had to fly through space to reach your earth. Of course, it took only an instant, but you know a ray of light from the sun takes full 8 minutes, and fancy in an evening suit and open waistcoat. Spirits don't freeze, but when one's in fleshly form, well. In brief, I didn't think, and set off, and you know in those ethereal spaces, in the water that is above the firmament, there's such a frost. At least one can't call it frost, you fancy, 150 degrees below zero. You know the game the village girls play, they invite the unwary to lick an axe in 30 degrees of frost. The tongue instantly freezes to it and the dupe tears the skin off, so it bleeds. But that's only in 30 degrees, in 150 degrees I imagine it would be enough to put your finger on the axe and it would be the end of it. If only there could be an axe there. And can there be an axe there? Ivan interrupted, carelessly and disdainfully. He was exerting himself to the utmost not to believe in the delusion and not to sink into complete insanity in axe. The guest interrupted in surprise. Yes, what would become of an axe there? Ivan cried suddenly, with a sort of savage and insistent obstinacy. What would become of an axe in space? Quel idée. If it were to fall to any distance, it would begin, I think, flying round the earth without knowing why. Like a satellite. The astronomers would calculate the rising and the setting of the axe, Gatsyuk would put it in his calendar, that's all. You are stupid, awfully stupid, said Ivan peevishly. Fib more cleverly or I won't listen. You want to get the better of me by realism, to convince me that you exist, but I don't want to believe you exist. I won't believe it. But I am not fibbing, it's all the truth. The truth is unhappily hardly ever amusing. I see you persist in expecting something big of me, and perhaps something fine. That's a great pity, for I only give what I can. Don't talk philosophy, you ass. Philosophy, indeed, when all my right side is numb and I am moaning and groaning. I've tried all the medical faculty, they can diagnose beautifully, they have the whole of your disease at their fingertips. But they've no idea how to cure you. There was an enthusiastic little student here, you may die, said he, but you'll know perfectly what disease you are dying of. And then what a way they have of sending people to specialists. We only diagnose, they say, but go to such, and, such a specialist, he'll cure you. The old doctor who used to cure all sorts of disease has completely disappeared, I assure you. Now there are only specialists and they all advertise in the newspapers. If anything is wrong with your nose, they send you to Paris. There, they say, is a European specialist who cures noses. If you go to Paris, he'll look at your nose. I can only cure your right nostril, he'll tell you, for I don't cure left nostril, that's not my speciality, but go to Vienna, there there's a specialist who will cure your left nostril. What are you to do? I fell back on popular remedies. A German doctor advised me to rub myself with honey and salt in the bath house. Solely to get an extra bath I went, smeared myself all over and it did me no good at all. In despair I wrote to Count Mattei in Milan. He sent me a book and some drops, bless him, and, only fancy, Hoffmann's extract cured me.